This is Mental, the podcast that destigmatizes mental health. I'm Bobby Timms.
I'm Annie Harris.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're talking all about coaching for young people as a factor in improving mental health. Before we get into the episode, we're just going to talk for a moment about neuro-linguistic programming, which is the specialty of this week's guest. This is a type of coaching whereby you focus on thought processes, usually negative, and ways you can try and improve them or create healthier thought patterns. In the episode, our guest talks a little bit about her own examples, having experienced anxiety and how it's very common with this condition, how your mind can spiral and you can end up focusing a lot on the worst case scenarios. Obviously, this is really quite a normal and understandable part of that condition, but is also something that we all experience at some point. Particularly when it comes to certain things we talk about in the episode, like public speaking. So there's a bit of context in terms of what neuro-linguistic programming is. In the episode, we refer to it as its abbreviation NLP quite a lot. So Annie, anything you want to add on that initially?
I hadn't actually heard a lot about NLP before this episode. The only exposure that I had to NLP was knowing about it through Derren Brown. I love Derren Brown so much. And he mentions neuro-linguistic programming quite a lot, basically like the language of the mind and things like facial expressions and tics and how he can basically tell what someone's thinking from like tiny, tiny movements of their face. That's the only thing I knew about it. So when I heard that we were having someone on the podcast that was a specialist in NLP, I was like, okay, there's some Derren Brown stuff going on right now and I need to be involved. So I'm looking forward to being educated a little bit more on how it can be beneficial to those with any mental health condition.
So would you have been surprised if he'd turned up?
Yes. I love
him. And he's like, I'm going to be on TV. I'm part of his latest experiment.
I am such a fangirl for Derren Brown.
Convince me to do something wacky. Take me.
Make me do that weird sleep thing, Derren. Yeah.
It is interesting and he fascinates me, but actually this also has all kinds of real world applications. And in the episode, we, for context, talk about comparisons between how NLP can have similar benefits to counselling, although they are separate. And so that's something I was quite keen to highlight, that they are different. This is considered coaching and not counselling or therapy because of the different kind of school of thought it comes from. And it's actually therefore less mental health focused. So people will have this kind of coaching if they want to work on things like their career. They'll have it if they want to work on like self-esteem and things that most definitely can be influenced by where your mental health is at, but may not always be areas you need to work on because of poor mental health. So it's a really broad set of tools that people can find uses for throughout their whole life. And so that's why this week's guest, Carol Lilly, in particular, focuses on trying to get this kind of education into schools, get young people empowered with the kind of tools to regulate and communicate their emotions. Because increasing this kind of understanding isn't just about tactics, it's also about building more emotional language. So people of all ages can better express their emotions, their thought processes, what they're going through.
You said anything that I would want to say, so I don't have anything to add at this point, sorry.
No, that's fine. It's just I'm so used to having the stats. But obviously with this, we're hearing it more from a personal perspective. So I guess in the whole episode is a bit of a case study as opposed to us having stats as the justification of something being useful. So
case study.
How fancy. So we'll get into the episode with Carol shortly. She'll tell you all about the kind of coaching she does, the kind of results she sees, and we get into where that fits within a mental health context. And in case you were wondering, like I was, her accent is from South Africa, because I did find it quite difficult to place. We'll get into that episode, but first, this week's self-care partner.
I'm recommending How to Be Human by Ruby Wax. Filled with witty anecdotes from Ruby's own life and backed up by smart science and practical mindfulness exercises, How to Be Human is the only manual you need to help you upgrade your mind as much as you've upgraded your iPhone. How to Be Human is, without exaggeration, a lifeline. Wise, practical, and funny, it is a handbook for those in despair. It is actually for everyone alive, for the curious or disillusioned or muddled or just plain happy. And that's a review from Joanna Lumley. To listen to your first book free with Audible, follow our link at bit.ly/mentalbooks. Links are in the description box for this episode.
So my interest in mental health started, I would say, probably about 4 or 5 years ago. So I've had my own challenges and struggles with mental health, so particularly depression and anxiety. And I think there's always been in that kind of department a bit of a stigma between not really always understanding the differentiation between the two. Anxiety is often linked to kind of stress. And I didn't have a great understanding of, you know, anxiety disorders myself. So I started to do quite a lot of research, and I was diagnosed with depression when I was probably in my late 30s. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to learn more about it. And I did some CBT. And yeah, and that's really where it all started. But I also saw a lot of gaps missing within the education sector as well. Great. And how we can support young people to kind of better understand mental health, positive and not so positive, you know, good and bad mental health. And what are the signs and how we can support them from a young age.
Okay, that's really great to hear. And so before we get into that, mm-hmm. what was your experience like with your own mental health and the support you got?
I think it was pretty good, actually. I've had different sort of forms of support, but I think initially I had it explained to me quite well. Mm-hmm. I think I was already quite knowledgeable about depression, so I kind of picked up the signs and symptoms early on, and I did a bit of research myself. So the support was really good, and the fact that I had CBT mm-hmm. Was very helpful as well to work out the kind of thought patterns and the kind of reprogramming and understanding, you know, how I could actually be in control of my own thoughts, which was very useful.
Great. And so in terms of then you having CBT, did that influence at all how you got into the work you currently do?
I suppose a little bit. I mean, I had a break from kind of all of that, and I was still working in my previous profession of doing kind of sales and advertising and business development. But it's when I started seeing signs of family members, you know, close family members and, you know, some close friends as well, similar symptoms and signs, and also in some young people that I know well, I just thought the support wasn't always kind of there, that the early intervention wasn't always there. It was kind mm-hmm. of having to wait for a period of time. So I thought, I really want to do something about this. I really want to help young people so that they're not getting to a stage where they reach adulthood. Right. And then they're going to have to deal with even, you know, more severe perhaps problems. If it's not dealt with early, it can kind of escalate into more serious mental ill health. So mm-hmm. that's kind of where it came.
Great. And that can be such a difficult thing when it comes to counselling. As your self-awareness rises, you start noticing things in others that sometimes they don't even see in themselves.
100%.
And so did you have that then, as you described, with family where maybe they had things they needed to work through?
Yes, definitely. And with some close friends as well, which can be quite challenging because you don't kind of, you can't really tell somebody. You can just be there as a support and guide them and say, you know, I've been through this mm-hmm. and the experience is different for every person. So you can't really say, well, actually, I know what you're going through, but you can still kind of empathise and say, look, I'm here for as a support. That's why I think I want to become more knowledgeable in different areas of mental health, is so that I can see the signs, but also know how to support young people and adults as well.
Yeah, that's good to hear, because it can be tricky when you see people you know that you're close to going through these things. But it should never be something to hold you back from being there and listening to them.
Of course.
You never need to have all the answers to still show up for them.
Definitely.
And it sounds like your early experience really helped you with that and helped you learn the kind of links between how we think and how our health, physical and mental, can change.
Yeah, definitely.
Depending on our thoughts and actions. Mm. Getting into the work you do now, could you talk us through how you got started in neuro-linguistic programming?
Yeah, so basically I qualified just over 3 years ago with a coaching academy. So I initially did my coaching qualification, my life coaching qualification. I then was thinking about doing a youth coaching qualification. I thought, actually, something I could kind of learn myself, because it's not that vastly different from life coaching. It's just kind of working with younger people as opposed to much with adults. So I looked into NLP. Somebody had mentioned it to me previously, and because I'd always had an interest in CBT, and there's quite a lot of similarities between the two. Mm-hmm. They are really looking at your kind of your thought process and how you can reprogram and change your thoughts, so therefore it changes the whole process of how you feel and how you therefore behave. And that led me down the path to qualifying as an NLP practitioner, which is very much about understanding how we communicate with others, but also essentially how we communicate with ourselves. Right. So it's really learning about your own kind of mental map of the world. And by learning how to understand yourself better, you're able to communicate a lot better with other people.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting the comparison there you've brought up with CBT, because mm-hmm. that's what I was thinking about earlier when you yeah. mentioned it and how it increased your awareness yeah. of how much it can help us to work on our thought patterns,
yes.
to get more control over mm-hmm. the way we think, and in particular with conditions like anxiety that you've yeah. experienced, how our thoughts can spiral.
Definitely.
And they can get away from us mm-hmm. in a way. I think it's an important one for listeners that may not be aware of sure. NLP, the kind of separation between where it fits yes. outside of counselling yes. but still with similarities.
Yes.
Obviously, you've gone through all the training, mm-hmm. so you're expert in when certain tools are appropriate, when leading the client in a certain way yeah. is the right thing for them. Could you talk us through a little bit more of that?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think for me, I use a lot of my coaching techniques and questioning techniques as an interlinking way of guiding and supporting somebody. And because obviously coaches are not there to be therapists or counsellors. Mm-hmm. It's a different sort of approach. But I think for me, NLP is very much about initially helping somebody to understand the way in which their brain is working, the way they see the world, the way they're internalizing information, because the way one person might make sense of a situation might be very different to another person. So it's getting them to understand the different ways in which they react using their senses, understanding if it's confidence that's an issue for them, for example, or self-esteem, or perhaps self-belief, getting them to use specific tools and techniques to help them around that. So one technique I use quite a lot with adults, but I've used with children as well, actually with my own son, I've used this with my younger son, is anchoring. So it's about putting yourself in a position of, if you're really anxious or your confidence is very low and you want to work on building your confidence, it's about using a part of your body and kind of getting yourself into that state of remembering a time where you felt confident, mm-hmm. and kind of almost visualizing that confidence. And then anchoring is really where you kind of, it's very difficult to explain without showing, but it's kind of where you use a certain, you can use your knuckle, you can use a shoulder, and it's really where you just gently press that part of your body when you're in that state, so that when you are feeling that you want to be confident and you kind of are feeling perhaps nervous or anxious or whatever it may be, you can elicit that state. It doesn't always work. This is not a fix-me tool at all. It's just mm-hmm. a set of techniques that can support people. Some people find different techniques work better than others. And it's one of those things we just have to practice and keep on doing it. And the more you understand the way you filter information. And for example, we all have an inner critic mm-hmm. where we speak to ourselves in both a subconscious and an unconscious level, really. Mm-hmm. And it's about kind of understanding how a conversation might occur. And you will filter that information in a different way to perhaps the person who's on the receiving end. And you'll take that information in and you'll filter it. And then you'll have that inner critic speaking to you. And it can be very damaging. It can be helpful, but it can be damaging in many ways. It's about kind of understanding how you take information in and how you communicate with yourself and others. And it's interesting how your self-awareness just rises. But there are so many different kind of tools and techniques. But a lot of it is based around your filtering process, your senses, how you communicate with yourself. So it's kind of really getting down to the basics of understanding all of that and how you're programmed. Right. So a lot of people behave in the same way when they're in a specific scenario, or perhaps if they're in a situation where it might become a bit conflicting or difficult, and you're programmed often to, it's almost like a habitual kind of wiring of the brain where you'll go and revert back to a certain way of behaving. Right. And it's about breaking that. It's NLP is great for breaking really unhelpful patterns of behavior and kind of understanding how you can do that. Mm-hmm. So it's very good in that respect.
I think that's a brilliant explanation of it. Very thorough. It's interesting. I've learned something there with anchoring. I was aware of that technique. I wasn't aware there was actually a term for it. And there's an example I've mentioned on the podcast before. A motivational speaker I really love called Lisa Nichols does that, where even though she travels the world speaking to huge audiences, she still gets really nervous and she still has that voice in her head that says, maybe this is the time I trip and fall off the stage the and everyone laughs at me. And whatever the worst case is for that day. So she developed this technique where she'd press the palm of one hand to pause the negative self-talk and then press the palm of the other to start the positive
That's
one.
That's great.
And on the surface of that, that can seem a bit odd, and often people see her do that and wonder, what is that about? But actually, it's a way for her to create a physical habit. And so she does it enough times, and somehow it triggers something in her. She knows how to behave in that scenario because she's trained herself
to
do it.
And that's the key, Bobby, the fact that she does it often. She's done it so many times that it's now become habitual.
It's a
new
habit.
Yeah, so it's a great technique, and you can teach it to children so, so very young to do that.
That's really interesting. And so one thing that's come to mind as you've been talking is a concern that quite a lot of my podcast guests bring up, that they'll be telling me their experience and I'm really connecting with it, and then they'll feel the need to frame it in a world context. So they'll be telling me something that can be genuinely sad or really tough, but then they'll say, oh, but other people have it worse than me. And that's something where I find that hard to hear, because I'm connecting with their experience.
Yes, of course.
And I'm like, but that doesn't change anything for you.
Sure.
All of this is relative to you. And we're all going through our own invisible struggle.
Absolutely.
If you had a client come to you with a similar saying, that's the kind of thing you'd pick up on, right?
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's about kind of reframing, and how are you speaking to yourself, and how can you look at the situation differently, but moving away from comparisons, because comparisons, again, is going to affect your communication with yourself, and again, how you communicate with others. And you hit the nail on the head there when you said about you're kind of trying to understand and connect with that person's experience, yet they're kind of saying, oh, but other people have it worse, you know, than me, which is fair enough. You know, there's always going to be somebody worse off than you are and having much more difficult experiences. But our experience, for us, it's about our mental map. So it's about getting that person to understand, okay, let's put aside any form of comparison and let's look at your situation, and let's see about how that makes you feel and what that means to you, and what that's bringing up for you. And then we can look at different tools and techniques, because I think that's a way sometimes of people kind of avoiding the seriousness of how it's affecting them, or kind of maybe perhaps a deterrent of how they can actually deal with it. And it's almost a little bit like brushing it under the carpet. Oh, but there are other people worse off than I am.
Right.
That's the kind of way I sometimes look at it, but obviously it's very individual to the person, and having to understand, well, why are they using that kind of language? What does that mean for them? You know, why are they saying that? Is it because it's a kind of avoidance? Is it because it's something they've heard from past experiences or from other people around them? It's interesting how we can break things down and then start to really understand how someone internalizes the world around them and then their own kind of mental map of the world. Yeah.
Absolutely, because it's coming from somewhere. Whilst you say it will vary for each person, my guess would be that it's this kind of societal pressure that we should keep calm and carry on, have this British stiff upper lip in this country. There's like a phrase for wherever you live. And I think people can really internalise that in the way they can internalise stigma. It doesn't really serve them. And so with that example, I often just tell people, oh, well, there's also always someone better off with you.
Absolutely.
And then they kind of, it can sometimes be enough to break them out of it, because they're like, oh, yeah, good point. And they realise that actually neither has a huge bearing on their life.
Absolutely. And this is exactly the point. And it's about kind of, you know, why do we say, let's just keep calm and carry on? Yeah, but we need to learn, how do we keep calm? We need to kind of understand how can we help ourselves in those situations and help our own thought process and dealing with situations, rather than say, oh, let's just keep calm, let's just carry on. Because that's when things start to resurface, is when you kind of push them and suppress them. It'll always come out in some destructive way, one way or another. Yeah.
One of my favourite quotes from Einstein was, everything should be made as simple as possible, but not simpler. Yeah. And I think that's what I'm reminded of when we talk about tools like this, because you hear something like keep calm and carry on. It's very reductive.
Yeah.
It doesn't serve you in every situation, and therefore it's useless for having as a life mantra.
Absolutely.
Whereas the kind of tools you empower those you work with to have, give them more options so they can be faced with all the new challenges that life throws at us. Definitely. And they have a whole toolkit, really.
Yeah, absolutely agree with you. Yeah, and that's why I think NLP, alongside coaching and mentoring, I mean, you don't have to go in schools and say, right, today we're going to learn about NLP, we're going to learn about this tool. You can kind of integrate it without using too much jargon. When we're able to educate young people on how to take control of their own thoughts and feelings and behaviours, they are going to be so empowered, and they'll be able to integrate into society in such a productive and healthier way. There's so many social pressures at the moment, and I'm sure they're just going to increase as you know, as we move forward in life. And there's no hiding from it, and there's no disappearing from it. We just have to kind of face it and deal with it, and provide as many solutions and support as we can in schools and at home, and as a society.
Yes, absolutely. It's something that makes me very relieved to already be an adult when I see what kids are growing up with today. Yeah. And again, it comes back to that, the sort of world context, doesn't it? That the young people that grow up with social media now, they don't have the comparison.
No.
So that is their whole reality.
Absolutely.
With all the filters and everything. I found out recently that 11% of photos on Instagram that have the hashtag no filter actually have a filter.
Right. Okay. Well, there you go. And that doesn't surprise me.
Even when you think something is real, that it's not necessarily.
And this is the problem. They're comparing themselves with a false sense of reality.
Mm-hmm.
And then those social comparisons are just, you know, increasing the anxiety, reducing the kind of self-esteem and self-belief. And it is very difficult. I mean, I have a teenage son, and I see it, and I talk to him all about it all the time. And I think young people just need to kind of sometimes just put the social media aside and just go out and get some fresh air, go and do some sports, go and find a club, a youth club, something, just to break away from all of that. And I think young people are kind of struggling with communication, which is a massive life skill, because we're almost taking it away from them.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons I really like how you describe the NLP approach in integrating these tools into people's lives, because there's so much crossover. There's so many things that I'm sure listeners are hearing you speak about and they didn't even realize was included in this kind of approach, because they're tools that are so integrated into lives, and luckily a lot of schools are embracing these already. What's your experience been like in terms of how open schools are to this approach?
I mean, I've been visiting primary schools, for example, where and the schools that I see that actually have such high morale within not just the students but with the staff and the parents as well, where there's less kind of challenges around behavior, improved attainment and attendance, just self-esteem, are the ones that are bringing in coaching and also mentoring and using NLP techniques in the classroom, because it really isn't that difficult to bring into the classroom at all. And the younger you teach children, I mean, you know, when they're very young, they just sponge anything you kind of throw their way. It's when they start getting into the teen years and going into secondary school, that's when the insecurities and the kind of, oh no, I can't do that, what people are going to think, start coming into play. So the primary schools that I've been to that bring NLP into the school, I've just seen fantastic results, really astounding results. And the kids are just happier, and the teachers are happier, and the parents are happier. You just see an overall improved kind of well-being for everybody, mental health. I have to say, I haven't come across many secondary schools that bring in NLP. I have come across a few, particularly private schools, who will have an NLP practitioner on site, or perhaps a mindset coach, someone who's qualified in NLP and coaching, and perhaps maybe two staff members who will be a sort of a student support role, will be in a kind of a well-being team, and they bring their tools and techniques and experiences as well in supporting the young people, which has worked really, really well in those schools that I visited. Personally, I think that this needs to be brought in primary school, because I think once they then have that transition into secondary, they're already equipped with those tools. It's not like somebody has to say to them, okay, so and so, you need to press your thumb now, or you have to do that now, or do this. They just know what to do. I'll give you an example. My son at one point was feeling quite low in confidence. There'd been some changes in his classroom, touched some friendship dynamics had changed. And he was having a little bit of a tough time. And we spoke about having his circle of excellence. So where he has this imaginary circle and he can imagine himself feeling good about himself. And he says things to himself and he kind of steps into the circle. And the sense of kind of confidence and empowerment just takes over him. And nobody knows what he's doing. He just takes a step forward. There are so many tools we can actually teach young people, and they actually really work. So I have seen such a phenomenal result in the schools that utilize NLP, but also where coaching and mentoring is very much part of the school's framework. And it's not just somebody coming in and talking about how coaching and mentoring and NLP, or let's put NLP aside, but how coaching and mentoring, for example, can benefit, you know, the teachers and the students. It's about actually, let's look at the school framework. How can we integrate this into the school so it becomes part of the culture? And those are the schools where you see the profound results.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I'm reminded of something my secondary school did, actually. They had these step back posters to try and reduce fights. Whether or not they were going at it from an NLP approach, it sounds quite similar, where it can be the simplest thing as you just stepping back, taking a moment away from a heated situation, and naturally your mind's going to slow down a little bit.
100%. I think sometimes as humans, we're chasing things and we're looking for a quick fix, but nothing happens quickly. It takes time. Every habit that's brought into our lives takes time. When we look at the habits that don't serve us, when we think about it, we've probably been doing them for a long, long time. It's the same with good habits.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes, like you said, about that taking a step back, moving yourself, removing yourself away, we have to kind of think differently and think, actually, sometimes the smallest changes bring out the best and biggest results. So we don't always have to think, oh my gosh, this CBT or NLP or coaching, it's just too much, it's too big. It could be just as simple as one technique and one tool that could make the biggest difference in your life. It's just really about breaking it down and kind of looking at things in a different light. I'm trying to remember a quote now. You said Einstein. I'm trying to think. I think it was Wayne Dyer who said, when you change the way you look at things, the things you look at change.
Yeah.
Which is really, for me, it just sums up what NLP and CBT and coaching and mentoring and all of this brings to young people. It kind of gives them such a greater self-awareness, and that's when their self-belief and their self-esteem starts to increase, because then they think, I don't need to be doing that, I don't need to be looking at social media. Do you know what? Because I've got my own tools, I've got my own techniques, and I'm really happy with who I am. I don't need to be comparing.
Right, absolutely. And the approach is, whatever form and school of thought they come from, they really are universal in that way. And
totally.
So often it's simply about increasing cognition and taking very emotive situations or thought processes and trying to take a moment to think them through.
Absolutely.
I'm somebody that's quite naturally keen on this. I'm very much a thinker, not a feeler.
Yeah.
That's generally my approach.
Yeah.
And therefore, it particularly makes sense to me.
Yeah.
And I remember when I first found out the Myers-Briggs personality types, a friend of mine who's a counsellor laughed at me because she's like, that's so typical of you to find a system and something you can read about to explain something as complex as emotions. Like, of course you want a system for them. But these things can be so helpful in just trying to raise your awareness. And often that's what happens, I'm sure, in your coaching. People, when they're at their very worst, can be in these emotional spirals.
Yeah.
And it's about grabbing one thing. It's like, okay, let's start with this.
Absolutely.
Let's break it down. Mm. Let's think it through. And so I'm particularly delighted to hear that you're starting right in primary schools, because that's so important.
Yeah.
And without these positive approaches, what they're instead internalising is the negative.
Yes, absolutely.
And you found out what we do here at the podcast through the petition we do for mental health education. And we're very much keen for that to be included at all ages, primary and secondary, because at the moment, we've got a situation where, because people aren't learning really anything about mental health, I went through my whole school experience with not a single lesson, hardly even a mention of mental illness.
Yeah.
And so it makes a lot of sense that people internalise that this is something we don't speak about.
Mm.
How is it I can go to school and we can talk about condoms, but we can't talk about depression?
Exactly.
And so I think that's why, whatever the approach is, the education is so key.
Yeah.
So that the children don't internalize the stigma.
Completely.
They come from a place of openness, yeah, of understanding.
Totally. And I think sometimes the school environment is so hugely beneficial to a young person, because we don't always know what environment that child is being raised in, mm-hmm, and what their background is. And although parents can be very supportive, and it has to be a kind of very holistic approach, so it's not really just school and just parents, it's society, it's the community, it's everybody. But I think children spend a vast majority of their time at school. And I think that if people are trained and have a better knowledge of mental health and how to spot the signs and how to kind of almost, it is kind of sometimes a bit of a topic that can be, you know, I wouldn't say overwhelming or daunting, but it kind of almost has that kind of cloud, that grey cloud effect, you know, where you don't want to talk about it because it's, oh, it's, mm-hmm, a difficult subject. But actually, when I deliver mental health to young people and even to adults, I try and always engage a little bit of, not, I wouldn't say humour, I'm not making fun of it in any way because it's a very serious topic, but kind of looking at the lighter side. We're all human beings. We're all led by our emotions. Every form of communication and behaviour all stems from our emotions. So we can have fun with it. You know, it doesn't always have to be so serious. So I think it's how adults in the education sector, in whatever sector it may be, kind of have that knowledge and training, and then how they then deliver that message to the young person. So they feel kind of, actually, you know, this isn't such a big deal. I mean, you know, we can talk about this. It's when it's suppressed and not spoken about, which, like I said, is that's when it can resurface to something quite serious, like an anxiety disorder or, you know, depression and things like that. And that's when a young person might think, I don't know what to do now. I'm just too overwhelmed. So we can bring this in actually really, really early. And like you said, it's got to be part of the core curriculum. Mm-hmm. We can't be just bringing in, I mean, I tend to not really go to schools and say, oh, I'll come in and do an hour on resilience, or, you know, what I do with confidence coaching, for example. I'd rather work with a school who wants to integrate this long term, because that's right, what you need to see the results.
And it's interesting you mentioned that, because that is something that some people bring up with our petition as a concern of viewing mental health and mental illness like this Pandora's box.
Yeah.
That if we don't do enough,
yeah,
we'll potentially open up more problems than we can deal with. And I can understand that that's coming from a place of genuine concern, but I also think that's coming from, at times, a point of ignorance as well.
Yeah, definitely.
Because people had similar concerns with sex education,
yes,
that if we start teaching it, all the 12-year-olds will be at it.
Yeah.
And that's not the case.
No.
And actually,
yeah,
I think children can be underestimated, actually. They have a great ability to self-filter up to a certain,
yeah,
point.
Definitely.
I remember for me, I grew up and I was not going to watch any movie that wasn't my age group. And I learned how to find out what the reasons it was rated that for was. Because I was like, if it's gore, I don't want it.
Yeah.
If it's rude language, I get that at home anyway.
Yeah,
I don't
mind.
And so, you know, this is why it's important that we work with children on this, that we can't protect them from everything, particularly in the world that we live in today.
Sure.
Finding out about mental health is only a Google away, but without any context, we don't know if they're reading real information or not.
Absolutely. This is the concern. And also what you were saying about, you know, children are going to, if they want to find something out, they will go and find it and search it. They have the internet at their fingertips, so they can just find any form of information. And I think there are a lot of websites out there, and there are a lot of films that depict ill mental health in a very negative light.
Right.
And I think that's why we need trained professionals who can work in schools, even actually working in schools, not just coming in to have a kind of a session, but actually working in schools permanently.
Mm-hmm.
And that is their role, and that is purely what they do. They are teachers in mental health and well-being, and that is what they deliver purely as a lesson, because that's when they're going to get the correct information from. There's a lot out there that's, you know, that's very, very valid and very supportive and helpful, but there is a lot that isn't as well, and that's the problem, that's a concern.
Right. And the thing I'd add to that as a final point on this kind of Pandora's box mentality is that's why the integration is so important.
Definitely.
That it's in schools as something permanent. It's not just one speaker coming in for 1 week.
Yeah.
And so I strongly believe that with mental health education all through primary and secondary, plus the training that we're pushing for teachers to get as well, then if anything does come up, the kids already have some skills to deal with it ahead of time. They know what teachers they can speak to. The staff have a baseline level of knowledge, and definitely, if they don't have the solution, they know where to signpost.
100%. I mean, why are the academic subject, you know, always kind of raise this level of high esteem? If we're not healthy mentally, we're not going to be successful in any area of our lives. So really, mental health needs to be the top priority as far as I'm concerned. I can't remember half of what I learned at school when it comes to history or, you know, some subjects. But I do remember the teachers that weren't perhaps trained professionals in mental health, but the ones that actually focused on our well-being and our emotional, mental and physical well-being and brought that into the lessons. Those are the ones that I remember. And those are the lessons that have stayed with me. So I think it's really, really, it's just so paramount. It's so important.
For sure.
Yeah.
And even for just people being a well-rounded person growing up and being in the job market and wherever else, I'm lucky to have the privilege to interview and hire people now. With that, someone can have all the best grades. They can have a shining degree from a red brick university, but if they're really struggling to keep their emotions in check in the room, they're going to struggle to get across how brilliant they are.
Absolutely.
And yet we're not taught that. You know, it's how to have a job interview, we're not taught that. But equally, we're not taught the any of the emotional regulation or context to deal with these situations.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's especially like heightened in the teen years when so much is going on for them with their brain development and changes physically and mentally and emotionally, that if they learn these techniques and they have a knowledge of actually... I don't know many schools that actually where the teachers actually talk to the young people about the brain and the different parts of the brain and actually about the amygdala and what's happening for them and why they are, you know, in that age where they risk taking it, sleeping more and how their brain's developing. When you actually give them that information, they can take more control of themselves and what's going on for them. Because I think that's the most important thing is, you know, if you have counselling or therapy or whatever it may be, once you have a greater self-awareness, you feel like you can, you're empowered to kind of take control of your life. And that's what we need to give young people. We need to be teaching them the fundamentals of how they then can go out into the real world and have those tools and how they can feel empowered. I mean, teaching them communication skills through NLP and coaching and all these sorts of things. It's vital. It's absolutely vital. Right. Yeah.
And I'm glad you've mentioned teenagers, because without the right knowledge, that's a really scary time in learning what's just you and what's everyone else.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's very easy for these young people to get to a place where they feel they're truly on their own because they don't understand what they're going through.
Yeah.
And whilst I'm really glad that there's more education around the kind of physical and scientific changes you go through, there's things like mood swings that are mentioned with no, oh, but here's how to deal with it.
Yeah, and this is why it's happening to you.
Yeah.
You know, this is what's going on in your brain at the moment, because it's a very difficult time, and it's a time where they often shut us out as parents and even maybe shut their teachers out, which can be quite difficult for their educators as well. And it's a time where you see this happening and you want to help, but you kind of, you know, there's that barrier. So that's why I think when they have the tools given to them quite young, we're not going to have so many challenges as they get older. You'll still have the same challenges, but it'll just be easier. Yeah,
absolutely. Grand. I would love to talk to you all day, but we are coming near the end of our time. So one last thing I want to check in with you on. With all the work you've done, how have you noticed that this has changed your own mental health?
I think whereas I was often questioning my self-worth and my own self-belief, that's where I feel my confidence has just improved and increased dramatically. And I now know that actually my thoughts are not me. I have control over my mind. I'm in control. Whereas before I didn't feel that way. I often felt like I had no control of what was going on in my mind. All these external factors in my environment I felt were in control of me. So I think what NLP and coaching has done for me, and it's also the people that I've met through my journey. And when you meet like-minded people, and when you meet people who, often when we meet people within mental health or coaching or NLP, whatever it is, you're going to have similar journeys, or you've been on kind of similar paths, or you've experienced things that have brought you to this place. It has really helped me understand myself better, communicate with myself better, have an increased self-awareness and self-worth. And I think also it's given me, I've always been a very compassionate person and I've always empathized with people, but it's given me a greater sense of compassion towards other people. And that, you know, sometimes good people make bad choices as well. And I think sometimes we can label people very quickly, and young people are labeled very quickly as being lazy or not motivated or difficult or challenging. But actually, you know what, when we start to understand the process of the human mind, and how that comes out externally, then we show more compassion to each other, which is key, I think, in the world that we live in, and being kinder to one another.
Great. That's a really good summary point. I don't know if I could do better myself. but it's also so important in highlighting how this is something that helps everyone.
Yeah.
When we work towards mental health, it's not about the 1 in 4, it's about the 4 in 4.
Absolutely.
And you don't need to be bad enough in your mental health to be diagnosed with a mental illness just to benefit from tools like this.
Absolutely.
So that's where we'll wrap up with.
Yeah.
And then in terms of if anyone wants to find out more about you and the work you do, maybe even get you into their school.
Yeah, that would be great. Yeah, fantastic. So you can find me on social media if you just type in Carol Lilly Coaching and Education. Just type that into Google. You'll find me on Facebook, LinkedIn, my website as well. And you can just email me at carol@clcoachingineducation.co.uk. And I'll leave my mobile number if anybody wants to give me a ring. So it's 077-871633-65, but just Google Carol Lilly, that's C-A-R-O-L, and my surname is L-I-L-L-E-Y, Coaching in Education, separate words, and you'll find me.
Great.
I think there's only one of me out there. With
I feel very well informed. The listeners have more ways to contact you than I do. Yeah. Great. Well, thank you so much
for speaking to me. It's a pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.